colonial control was a key plank of our program. The lessons of that for today are important to grasp. 50 years ago, we used to say that the Puerto Rican people were a divided nation, one-third of us living in the United States and two-thirds in Puerto Rico. Today, those statistics have been dramatically reversed. Some 5.8 million Puerto Ricans now reside in the United States, while just 3.2 million reside on the island, according to the 2020 census. 5/8 of our population, in other words, is now here. There are today 4 Puerto Ricans in Congress with a vote: Nidia Velázquez, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Richie Torres from New York, and Darren Soto from Central Florida. There is only one in Congress from the island, Resident Commissioner Jennifer Gonzalez, and she has no vote. The bulk of the political power of the Puerto Rican people, in other words, is now here in the United States. All of these changes affect how activists and scholars approach the real-world solutions to Puerto Rico's colonial condition, especially in the wake of the debt crisis, PROMESA, Hurricane Maria, a series of earthquakes, all of which have combined to bring unprecedented calamity to the island's residents. As I have urged repeatedly for years, there's an urgent need for more anti-imperialist scholars to dedicate themselves to analyzing how changes in the world capitalist economy have manifested themselves in Puerto Rico over the past 20 or 30 years. It is time we acknowledge that globalization has rendered historic concepts of national independence almost meaningless. You no longer need foreign armies to control a population when you can read everyone's mail, tap everyone's phone, empty a country's coffers, and paralyze its economy from afar through satellites, instant wire transfers, and simple cancellations of bank credit lines. Today, small nations need more creative and flexible tactics to defend themselves from bullying by larger ones, to assert national sovereignty in an increasingly interdependent world. And Puerto Rican activists will never successfully tackle such problems with rote references to conditions 50 years ago. I don't claim to have all the answers, only that we must work harder than ever to find solutions, and that we must never forget to ask what class interest is served by any solution. My observations tonight are not meant to needlessly cast fault on anyone, only to emphasize that the crucial test of our ideas and actions, no matter how high-sounding the words, comes in the crucible of popular struggle, especially if that struggle requires confrontation with the very institutions to which you belong or that employ you. That is how it was more than 50 years ago when I first became a young lord. And judging by the widespread youth rebellions across the nation, the Black Lives Matter, immigrant rights, and climate change movements, that is how it will continue to be in the future. Because all the accumulated knowledge and experience of radicals and progressives and revolutionaries mean nothing unless we draw the right lessons, unless they lead us to a freer, more just world, one where the fight against class oppression an empire remains at the center of everything we do.
Juan Gonzalez, speaking at the CUNY Graduate Center, that's the City University of New York, his speech, Latinos, Race, and Empire. You can watch the full speech, actually the trilogy of speeches, all three of his farewell speeches, at democracynow.org. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlin. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Professor Andrew Ross from New York University on the new book that has just been published by Orr Books called Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. It's a real eye-opener. And Heidi Boghossian and I speak about Michael Ratner, the founder of our show, the former president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael passed away 6 years ago, but several weeks after he died, Heidi and I spoke about his contribution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
What's the connection between cars and jails? Every day, more than 50,000 Americans are pulled over by police officers while driving. Most of them will come away from the encounter owing money to the municipality or the county in which they were stopped. Some will be arrested. They will join the nearly 9 million Americans to cycle through our country's jails each year. Police can choose from hundreds of traffic code violations to make a pretext stop and conduct a vehicle search. This may result in a fine or even arrest. American consumer law has long held that the automobile is a freedom machine, consecrating the mobility of a free people. Yet paradoxically, the car also functions at the crossroads of two great systems of unfreedom and immobility: the credit economy, and the American carceral system. We speak today about this situation with Andrew Ross, who, along with his co-author, Julie Livingston, has investigated this paradox and written the book Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. It's just been published by Orr Books. The book shows how the long arms of debt and carceral state operate in tandem in the daily life of car use and ownership. Andrew Ross is a professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU, New York University, and a social activist and analyst. He has authored and edited numerous books and has written for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, and Al Jazeera. Andrew Ross, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's terrific being able to interview you, Andrew. Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality is a really terrific book. I've just finished reading it. I recommend it to everybody. Orr Books published it. And I want to ask you about the book. We've got about 25 minutes, Andrew. Let me ask you this. You and Julie Livingston have written the book, Cars and Jails. What's the relationship between cars and jails?
Oh, there's so many of them. This is what we discovered in the course of writing the book. But basically, the book is about all of the ways in which car ownership and car use are entangled with the criminal justice system and also with the debt system. In other words, all of the ways in which financialization, which is a primary mode of capital accumulation in our economy these days, how the debt economy also bites in, takes a big bite out of household income for car ownership and car use.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that the amount of debt that people owe on their cars is almost equal to the over $1 trillion amount of debt that students owe.
It doesn't get the same kind of attention as student debt does. I've been active in the student debt cancellation movement myself for 10 years, so I've contributed to that scrutiny of student debt. But auto loan debt has actually doubled in the last 10 years, and it's creeping up there towards, you know, the aggregate levels of student debt. And there are, you know, the primary reasons for that were the entry of subprime lending, just predatory in nature, into the market. And also the elongation of loan terms to 84 months or longer. The average loan term now is 72 months. And so the upshot is that a monthly average car payments, car loan payments, have been really rapidly increasing. They're now more than a whopping $700 a month. That doesn't include insurance, of course. That doesn't include basic maintenance costs. And also, what is very profitable from the part of view, from the point of view of financing, is what's called the after parts business. If you need a new battery, you need a new transmission system, you need a new set of tires, these are all things that you can get financed too. So all of these debts add up and contribute to the overall debt burden.
You know, there's some sympathy for students, I guess moral sympathy, because students are contributing to the society, and why should they be burdened by this huge debt when their knowledge is going to go into making things better? But you don't have the same kind of sympathy for people that borrow money on cars, do you? Even though cars are important for the economy as well.
That's absolutely right. And that's hopefully this book can help change some of that mentality, because, you know, the way I see it is that education is a public good. It's a social good, along with housing and along with health care. But transportation is also a public good, but it's not necessarily always seen that way, and it certainly has never been funded that way in this country. And we don't have a movement now for student debt cancellation and student debt reduction. College for All is the slogan. We also have Housing for All, which is the housing justice slogan, and Medicare for All, I guess, is the healthcare movement slogan. We don't yet have a movement for transportation for all, although we absolutely do need one. We need to think about transportation as a public good up there along with these others.
For those of you who've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Professor Andrew Ross from New York University. He and Julie Livingston have written, just published book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. Andrew, you use the concept of carceral state in the book. What is that?
Well, that's a term that that describes the kind of society we increasingly live on, where the prison industrial complex, what people often refer to as the prison industrial complex, which is a massively profitable enterprise, occupies an ever greater portion of regional economies and state economies, but also where a lot of the techniques of punishment and control and surveillance, which are central to criminal justice, have become much more prevalent and pervasive in society at large. One example is, and we devote a whole chapter to this in our book, is the extension of surveillance of all of us through automobiles. These days, cars are spying on us, quite frankly. There's a computer hidden inside the console, and it's documenting and gathering data on all of our conduct, our locations, sometimes our phone conversations, and it sends that data to the car makers, who will sell that data on the open market to anyone who wants to buy it, not just government agencies and police departments, but corporations. Just one example of this extensive surveillance system which operates through the car and basically is a dragnet for all of us.
One of the reasons that the intelligence, quote, community went after Edward Snowden was that he released information about how cell phones were used to spy on us and household appliances can be used to spy on us. And now we have cars that can spy on us. It's really extraordinary. Andrew Ross, what's the role played by automobiles in the disproportionate incarceration of black, brown, and poor people? And why is the automobile a trap that impoverishes and captures people with devastating consequences for their lives?
Well, this is very well documented, Michael, that, you know, the disproportionate number of traffic stops that, you know, sends people into prison, the disproportionate number of fines and tickets and punishments and debts they accumulate along the way, the disproportionate high interest rates that are attached to auto loans for for black buyers in particular, or buyers of color. These are all pretty well documented. What we try in the book, however, what we try to do is show how systematic these things are. That they're not, you know, they're sort of random, random money grabs on the part of individuals or small firms or large corporations. They are part of a system in which the carceral economy intersects with the debt economy. And in particular, it preys upon poor people and disproportionately minorities. And these are the people who end up in prison overwhelmingly. I teach in a prison education program, and I, regular contact with that population, and that's who they are.
Well, you bring me to my next question, Andrew Ross. Cars and Jails was researched and written under the auspices of the NYU Prison Education Program Research Lab. A number of formerly incarcerated people were involved as researchers within the project. Please talk about what these people did. Is this really a unique project, isn't it?
Well, I'd love to talk about that, Michael. We offer a two-year associate's degree in Walcombe Men's Prison in Ulster County. It's about 2 hours north of New York City. And when our guys are released, we get scholarships for some of them to continue on at NYU in New York to finish their four-year degrees. And some of them we train as researchers. We call them peer researchers because most of what they do is go out in the field and interview formerly incarcerated peers. So it's a kind of innovative research or data gathering model, if you like. So a lot of the interviews fed into the research we did for this book. The initial interviews, we noticed that people talked about cars all the time, how they dreamt about cars in prison, you know, regaining their freedom and hitting the open road when they got released, or their nostalgia for the glamorous life on wheels before they were incarcerated. And then a strange thing happened, which turned out to be a very important clue for us. One of our peer researchers got arrested on a minor traffic violation and reincarcerated. The same thing then happened to another, and a similar thing happened to a third. And then we began to get a sense from our direct experience of how this cycle of incarceration and reincarceration involves automobiles very directly as a vehicle of capture and control. And that's why we decided then to launch the bigger project, which led to the book itself.
Andrew, you cite a figure that was shocking to me. You wrote that 50,000 Americans are pulled over by police every day. These stops can be pretextual stops. What's a pretextual traffic stop, and why is this legal?
There's a long history behind that question, Michael. You know, it has to do with the rapid growth of police departments in the 1920s, which was largely due to the need to monitor traffic safety. So you saw this jump in a very substantial jump in the growth of police departments, and then there was a long debate in the courts, which lasted over the course of a few decades, about how the Fourth Amendment guarantee against unreasonable searches would apply to vehicles on the road. And ultimately, because the road is considered public, considered a different environment from a private home, the courts agreed to give a huge amount of discretionary authority to the police to conduct these searches and seizures on the pretext of some violation. And the stops routinely are done on the pretext of a traffic code violation, but they lead to more intensive searches and seizures. So the 50,000 stops a day, some of them result in fatalities if the driver has the wrong skin color. Many more result in arrests and lead to detention. But most of them, the majority of these stops, result in traffic tickets. which is a form of punishment and a form of what we call state debt, where the state is the creditor.
If a person buys a car, and in most cases they buy it on credit, and then can't pay off the car, what happens? Why do you say, and you've got a chapter called Why Do So Many Owe So Much, why is driving a car a tightly sprung debt trap, as you call it?
Well, first of all, unless you live in a, you know, a dense urban neighborhood where with easy access to decent public transit, you absolutely need a car. It's sort of mandatory in the U.S. Car ownership is compulsory, so there's nothing optional about going into debt in order to buy a car, and by far the majority of car purchases are financed. The average cost of a car now is $40,000. Sooner or later, because of the rise of subprime lending, if you don't have a steady or a high income, you're going to end upside down on your loan, which is to say you owe more than the car is worth. So what you do then is you fold the balance into a new loan, which has a much higher interest rate, after your car is sold or repossessed. Now, if you're formally incarcerated, you're red meat for lenders and dealers when you walk into a dealership, because your credit score is going to be shot from years of inactivity, and you're basically at the mercy, much more at the mercy than the rest of us. You're much more at the mercy of these predatory lenders. So you're going to walk out of that, walk out of the lot, or drive out of the lot with a car you can't afford. And we found this in case after case in our interviews, people driving, having acquired fairly expensive cars and finding it easier to do that than find an apartment they could rent, because the dealers will only finance expensive cars for them. They won't sell you a Honda, they'll sell you a Mercedes. And the consequences of that are devastating, because they know they're going to repossess that car in a year or two and then sell it to some other sap. That's how the system works.
And you've documented that in this very fine book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. Julie Livingston and Andrew Ross wrote the book. We're speaking on Law and Disorder with Andrew Ross. Andrew, I understand the book is available from Orr Books. That's orrbooks.com. And I wanted to ask you a question that's really troubled me since I read the book. Can American citizens actually go to jail or prison for owing money?
Technically, no, because debtors' prisons were abolished in 1833. But the back door to the debtor's prison has been wide open for a long, long time. And here's how it works, Michael. If you have an unpaid civil debt judgment, or actually owe the state money in the form of traffic debt, you'll end up in court, and the creditor will issue a number of calls for debtor's examinations, what are called debtor's examinations. And sooner or later, you're not going to be able to take a day off work. You're going to miss a court appearance. At that point, the creditor pressures or lobbies the judge to issue a contempt of court for failure to appear. So by far, the majority of detentions that result or probations that result come from that contempt of court. It's basically an arrest warrant. And those kinds of cases are filling up small claims courts across the country, paradoxically.
That's really amazing. Andrew, talk about how traffic fines are used to partially finance city and municipality budgets.
Well, this is a terrible story. I mean, it became more publicly known after the unrest in Ferguson several years ago, when it, you know, became pretty obvious that the city was basically financing its budgets from traffic tickets and fines and fees. We've all been caught in a speed trap, or most of us have been caught in a speed trap when a local municipality will set artificially low speed limits and then to catch unsuspecting motorists. That has a long history, but in recent decades, that kind of what's called revenue policing has become much more systematic. And it's basically, in many jurisdictions, it's a primary means of meeting local budgets, for not just for courts and law enforcement, but for, you know, general operating budgets. It's a terrible way of funding governments, and it's a regressive form of taxation, because the fine and fee system in this country is flat fee. Everyone gets the same ticket. If you are a high-income motorist, it's not going to be a deterrent, and it's not going to make much difference at all to your pocketbook. But if you're a low-income motorist, it can have devastating consequences, because these kinds of fines and tickets can cascade into much larger sums, from penalties and late fees and surcharges and so on and so forth, and ultimately can lead to detention.
So, Andrew Russ, how would you overhaul the traffic policing?
Well, the easiest way, and has been done in a few jurisdictions, is to withdraw armed police officers from the business of traffic safety. The other way is, the other thing really to do is to make sure that if people do end up in court as a result of traffic fines, excessive policing, then the courts and their judges have to consider ability to pay, which is the law of the land, but in many local courts and municipalities, that's not the case. The judges don't consider your ability to pay, and that's a big problem. And then there's the issue of the arrest warrants. No judge should be allowed to issue arrest warrants for unpaid civil debt judgments.
How would you change auto financing?
Well, auto financing is almost completely unregulated. I mean, it's barely regulated. And there are many private workarounds for the usury caps. Every state has a limit, a usury cap, on how much interest can be charged. But there's all sorts of workarounds and loopholes that are used by lenders. In New York State, for example, there's something called the retail installment contract. It's basically a euphemism for an auto loan, and it's a way of getting around the 16% usury cap in New York State. They don't call it a loan. They call it a retail installment contract, so you can go higher, and the criminal cap is 25% in New York State. So you find a lot of subprime lenders are issuing loans at 24.99%. They call them retail installment contracts, however. That's just one example of the loopholes.
We're speaking with Andrew Russ, who's co-written with Julie Livingston a really scintillating breakthrough book, Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality. The book is available at OrBooks, orbooks.com. Andrew, I recently saw two maps, one of Europe and one of America, placed side by side. And the maps showed public transportation in terms of railroads and trolley lines, buses. The map of Europe had so many lines on it that it blotted out the color of the map, but the map of America had only a few lines on it. What would it take to change the transportation system in the United States?
Well, that's a huge challenge because it's the autocentric build-out of infrastructure in the U.S. after the war was so systematic and so comprehensive that's why, you know, car ownership is so compulsory across the country. There's an 80 to 20% split in terms of transit funding, transportation funding from Congress. 80% goes to infrastructure that facilitate car use, and only 20% goes to public transit. We would need to reverse those numbers to begin with to see any significant difference in infrastructure investment. That did not happen as a result of the recent Biden administration bills, the infrastructure and the climate bills, which further entrenched car use, in my view. for the next 30 or 40 years or so. There was an opportunity to turn that around, and that was a missed opportunity in those administration bills. That would just be the start, and that's just the funding part of it. Then there's also the mentality piece of it, Michael. And that's more difficult because the car.
But the consequences of all these cars on the road is climate change, actually. And that's something they're just not addressing adequately. Well, Andrew Ross, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time on Law and Disorder, but I wanted to thank you for being on the show. Cars and Jails, Freedom Dreams, Debt, and Carcerality is a book that's just been published by Orr Books. That's orrbooks.com. You and Julie Livingston have written it. It's a real breakthrough book. I congratulate you for writing this book. It's an important book, especially for people that are involved in the abolition movement for prisons, and also just people that want to understand how the American capitalist economy really functions. So I thank you, Andrew Ross, for being on Law and Disorder, and I appreciate your good work. You have a good new year.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You take it easy, Andrew.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Ratner died after an 8-month battle with cancer on May 11th of 2016. Today, we dedicate our show and reflect back on Michael Ratner's contribution to the movement and his role in the show Law and Disorder. Heidi, how did you first meet Michael?
Michael, when I started working at the National Lawyers Guild in 1999, I, of course, knew of Michael's reputation and the many cases he's brought and the various issues that he championed over the years. I first actually saw him at a Columbia Law School event in 1999. I think it was involving Cuba and the embargo. And then in my office, I saw his name everywhere because he was a longtime supporter of the Guild in many respects and was universally loved, respected, admired, and seen as a mentor to many new generations of young radical attorneys and legal workers. Then you called me in 2004 and invited me to be a part of this show. And so I really started to get to know Michael, the person, that year, and remember soon after attending an award ceremony at Columbia Law School where he got their Public Interest Law Foundation Award in 2005, and also the Columbia Law School Medal of Honor. And from there, as Law and Disorder took off, it's just been a mixture of really rare, serious, thoughtful interviews, interactions with a lot of good humor thrown in. The humanity also that Michael brought, unexpected surprises. I remember once after speaking about my Armenian grandfather and mother escaping the genocide, a few weeks later a big box arrived from Amazon with no name on it, and I opened it up and it was a really heavy, complete anthology on the Armenian genocide. And I quickly realized Michael had sent it without a note, just a very thoughtful, generous person. Michael, I know that you go back far longer than I do with Michael, so I'd like to hear how you first met him. But I also know that he had an interesting take on the rule of law.
A take that we all share. But I first met him when I lived around the corner from him in Greenwich Village back in the early 80s. And Michael had just gotten elected as the president of the National Lawyers Guild. And he walked around the corner and schlepped up four flights of stairs to our walk-up where I was living with my wife, Debbie, and our very young son, Eli. And he asked me if I would be on the editorial board of Guild Notes, which was the Lawyers Guild magazine. I said, sure, I'd like to do that. And that's when I started working with Michael. Michael's conception of the law, American law, well, he initially started out, I guess like we all did, Heidi, thinking that the law was a civilized way of resolving disputes. And whatever defects it might have, those could be fixed. Well, he quickly realized that that was not the case. And he came to understand that the law was a method of social control exercised by the 1% over the rest of us and exercised by any means necessary for as long as possible so they could keep their privileges and power. And that was the perspective that Michael had throughout his entire adult life as a litigator. He wanted to expose the law, undercut the law, change it if he could, change it in tandem with the movement, because he thought that lawyers in the final analysis played an auxiliary role and that it was the people's movement that caused social change. But he thought that the movement could make use of the law, and he wanted to be an instrument in that endeavor.
Michael, we had a lot of fun over the last 14 years, and I will cherish these memories. We've been likened here on Law and Disorder by a few as the car talk of legal affairs show. And I also remember when I got an award from the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild in 2011, you and Michael introduced my getting that award and were as humorous and insightful and really magnanimous as you always have been on the radio show, and I thought that sort of summarized the kind of working relationship we had.
We weren't that magnanimous. You did a good job. You ran the Guild for 15 years, and the Guild caused a lot of trouble under your tenure, Heidi.
I hope you mean good rabble-rousing.
But, you know, I think we should say something about some of the cases that
yes,
Michael handled and talk about how he came to do what he did. He came from an upper-middle-class Jewish family in Cleveland, went to Brandeis, which was a fairly radical place in the 60s. You know, Herbert Marcuse, the famous philosopher, was there. He was a classmate of Angela Davis's. When he got out, he was accepted to Columbia Law School. He wasn't all that political then. He devoted his first year exclusively to studying, did pretty well, came out first in his class, went on to the Law Review.
Not surprising.
But what changed him was what happened when the police attacked the students at Columbia back in 68. Columbia had been expanding its campus into the Harlem area. It wanted to build a gymnasium with two entrances, one for the privileged Columbia students and one for the Harlem population. And it was also extensively tied up with America's prosecution of the war in Vietnam. So the students held a sit-in, and the Columbia authorities called the cops on the sit-in. Michael was caught up in that, beaten up. 700 people were arrested. 200 people were sent to the hospital. The National Lawyers Guild came and defended those students.
That became really the beginning of their well-known mass defense program, and they've been defending people in the streets of protest ever since.
It certainly did. I mean, the Lawyers Guild was really a victim of the McCarthy era, which we were just coming out of even in the 60s. And that defense revivified the Lawyers Guild in New York City and then later on nationally. And Michael was on the ground floor of that. So then he went on when he graduated from law school. He worked for the Legal Defense Fund, which was the legal arm of the Black
movement
at the time. Moved down to Baltimore, lived in a motel, did work on school desegregation, came back to New York, got a job with Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first Black judge in the federal judiciary.
And he always spoke so highly of her.
And vice versa. She thought he was the best clerk she ever had. And then in 71, when he finished his clerkship, he started working for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was a scrappy, small little organization then. The first week, they sent him up to Buffalo to the Attica prison. Rockefeller was the governor then. Rockefeller wanted to be the president. He didn't want to be looked upon as being soft on prisoners. And when the Attica prisoners took over the prison, the governor called in the state troopers. 43 people were murdered by the state troopers. The Center for Constitutional Rights got in on it and sent Michael up to take statements to try to figure out what to do. And so Michael's first lawsuit was actually called Attica People Against Rockefeller. They tried to get the state to appoint a prosecutor to prosecute the murderers. They didn't succeed on that. But that started Michael off in his political representation from 1971 until 2015.
And Michael, I think for listeners who may not totally understand the nuances of some lawyering, Michael was really a radical attorney, and that's kind of a dying breed. Lawyers who will really take chances. They will take cases because they believe so firmly in the underlying principle and the violations that have occurred that even if the possibility of success in court is very low, they will still take the case to get that message out into the public's eye. Yeah, and that Michael believed in that.
Absolutely. And you know, to work with the movement in doing that.
Yeah.
He didn't believe American law in the final analysis was compatible with democracy, nor did he believe that it was compatible with the rule of law. We saw that most clearly with what happened after 9/11 and the setting up of the offshore prison in Cuba, the creation of a surveillance state, the massive harassment, the militarization of the police, the FBI's spying. But Michael understood that fundamentally. He knew that the rule of law and democracy was not compatible with capitalist law. And he knew that capitalism wasn't compatible with an egalitarian society. And it was that understanding, I think, that empowered him in the litigation that he undertook.
Michael was also an activist, as I think we all are on the show. He opposed Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse, as well as the Iraq War. He served as an expert witness at a mock tribunal staged by the Bush Crimes Commission at the Columbia University. More recently, in May 2014, he resigned from the advisory board of the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis, where, as you said, he went to school, because the university's president cut ties with Al-Quds, a Palestinian university, after a student demonstration there. So that's who Michael was. If he saw an injustice, he would do something about it.
No, he was in total solidarity with the Palestinian people. In fact, he organized and got the financial support to set up Palestine Legal, which is fighting back against the repression of Palestinian
with the New York,
students.
With the National Lawyers Guild.
Absolutely.
Right. That was very important and still is.
I think that if you want to look back at some of his most significant cases, Heidi, he sued Ronald Reagan for the funding of Contras in Nicaragua and for invading Grenada. He sued George Bush 41, the first one, for invading Iraq without congressional authority.
Mm-hmm.
He sued Bill Clinton for warehousing Haitians with HIV in the offshore prison camp, which we now know as Guantanamo.
He served as special counsel to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, assisting in prosecuting human rights crimes.
He sued the Secretary of Defense under Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, for torture. He sued Indonesian generals, a Guatemalan defense minister who he served when the guy was being given a degree at Harvard. He sued a Haitian dictator, all for human rights abuses.
And he tried to get Clinton to stop the strategic bombing during the Kosovo War.
He sued the FBI for spying on Central American Solidarity activists and CISPES during the 80s. He sued the Pentagon for restricting press coverage of the Gulf War.
He won a case on behalf of victims of the Bosnian Serb leader for war crimes.
And he organized what they called the Guantanamo Bar Association, which was the greatest mass mobilization of lawyers the country's ever seen. He got 500 lawyers to come in after they won the case of Rasul versus Bush, which established that the prisoners in the offshore prison camp in Guantanamo had the right to habeas corpus. They had the right to challenge their detention. They had the right to go in front of a court and tell the judge, I don't think I'm being held legally. Let's look into this. A habeas corpus, the fundamental, it's written into the U.S. Constitution. And he restored the habeas corpus and then organized 500 lawyers to continue with those cases. They didn't totally win, but they got 500 out of some 700 prisoners out of there.
A Herculean task.
You know, and we should also mention that he was the president of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights,
right,
which is kind of the European version of the
CCR.
CCR, yeah.
And I think when it all comes down to his legacy, he will be remembered as a compassionate, loving, really humanitarian attorney who was really loved by all who knew him.
And that sea of people, which includes you and me, Heidi, and our producer, Jeff Brady, who he influenced and continues to motivate. I wanted to say something about Michael in perspective, because Michael Ratner had no funeral. He wasn't religious. Religion to him was superstition. Being part of a sect was too narrow and confining. The Jewish heretic who transcends Jewry belongs to a Jewish tradition. The historian Isaac Deutscher had a phrase for it, the non-Jewish Jew. Michael Ratner was in line with the great heretics, rebels, and revolutionaries of modern thought, Spinoza, Heine, Marx, Luxembourg, Trotsky, Freud. They all went beyond the boundaries of Jewry, finding it too narrow, archaic, constricting. I don't wish to stretch the comparison. Michael was not so much a radical thinker as a man of action. But his intellectual understanding, and he was extremely well-educated, powered his activity. He had in common with these great thinkers the idea that for knowledge to be real, it must be acted upon. As Marx observed, hitherto philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point now is to change it. Like his intellectual predecessors, Michael Ratner saw reality in a state of flux, as dynamic and not static, and he was aware of the constantly changing and contradictory nature of society. Michael was essentially an optimist and shared with the great Jewish revolutionaries an optimistic belief in humanity and a belief in the solidarity of humankind. One of the last times I saw Michael, I was in a singing class with his son Jake and Jake's companion Elena and his daughter Anna, and our friend Jennifer Hobbs and my wife Debbie. We took a class on the Upper West Side called Anyone Can Sing, and we were attempting to learn how to sing, and we thought, you know, we'll put Michael on FaceTime and we'll sing his favorite song. Michael's favorite song was the Internationale. And he was home, just out of the hospital, sitting in a padded Barca lounger type chair in his living room, laying back and looking at us on FaceTime. And we were looking at him through the iPhone, and we sang the first verse, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's in birth." And we could see him smiling, laying back in the chair. And then we sang the second verse, "No more tradition's chains shall bind us, arise, ye slaves, no more enthrall. The earth shall rise on new foundations. We have been naught, we shall be all." And Michael was really smiling by then. And then we sang the last verse. And that verse is, "'Tis the final conflict. Let each stand in their place. International humanity shall be the human race." And when we sang the last verse, Michael raised his right fist, and he sang along with us in French.
In the next former update, Michael Ratner discussed how Israel continues to slaughter innocent Palestinian civilians using disproportionate force. It's called the Dahiyah Doctrine. the Israelis are practicing what they call the Dahiya Doctrine. What is this?
Well, at least many of us believe, and I think they are, practicing what's called the Dahiya Doctrine. For all our listeners, it's D-A-H-I-Y-A. And I like to call, when I talk about this, the Dahiya Doctrine, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange, because the first cable that illustrated what the Dahiya Doctrine was or is came out of WikiLeaks. And it has to do with the way Israel fights its wars against Palestinians or others. Dahiya was a section of Beirut in Lebanon. And what the Israelis did in the 2006 war is they leveled that section entirely. Everything, every building, nothing stood. Disproportionate force. Disproportionate force is, of course, a key guideline to whether you're committing a war crime or not. It's a war crime to use disproportionate force. If you want to, you know, kill an enemy soldier in a neighborhood, you can't kill 10,000 civilians to kill one soldier. You can't kill 100. You have to use what's called proportional force. You can't go after civilian objects. You can't go after civilians or civilian homes. Well, the Dahiya Doctrine is what Israel actually practiced in 2006, leveling a neighborhood, a form of collective punishment, a form of what Israel is saying we're going to do to anybody that attacks us. We're going to show them it's not simply an eye for an eye. It's your entire body. It's your whole infrastructure. It's everything. That's 2006. Right after that devastation, demolishment of a village in a part of Beirut, rather, a general from Israel said, what we have now is the Dahiya Doctrine. And it's not just a proposal. That's what we do. And he actually said, we will use disproportionate force when we're fighting these wars. So that's an open and notorious admission of a war crime.
A so-called party admission.
It's a party admission from a legal term. But yes, it's basically saying we're committing a war crime. Because if you look at the Geneva Conventions, it says you can't use disproportionate force. And here you have a general saying, we're going to use disproportionate force. And that's not a proposal, he says. That's an approved doctrine. So now we flash forward to this recent war, if you want to call it that, the recent massacre that took place in Gaza. And, of course, we've been reading about what's going on there, and you look at the statistics from the Palestine Committee on Human Rights, for example. 2,168 people have been killed. 2,168. Of that, 76.6% are civilians. Three-quarters are civilians. Of that, 30% of the civilians killed are children. 23% overall are children. So of this 2,168, 24% roughly were children. So that's what you would call the practice of the Dahiya Doctrine. The overwhelming use of force, disproportionate use of force, that winds up killing way more civilians than appropriate military targets. Now, the second part of that, of course, is a report that came out of the United Nations recently. Someone named Pernille Ironside, who's in charge of UNICEF for the UN, and she's been spending her time in Gaza, gave a very important press conference last week about the damage that's going on in Gaza. And the statistics were completely numbing. The main one that I take away from it is 400,000 people have been displaced in Gaza. That's basically one out of four people have been displaced. One out of four of a population of 1.8 million. Of that, 17,000 houses have been destroyed, 100,000 people completely homeless in Gaza. How long will it take them to rebuild that, assuming they ever get to rebuild it? She says a minimum of 18 years to rebuild it. So what you've seen is the utter and complete use of disproportionate force in Gaza, the Dahiya Doctrine. And I want to just close this segment to say, why are we standing by and allowing this to happen? Here we have a war crime being committed in front of our faces, admission by Israel it's doing it, a disclosure by WikiLeaks showing again the importance of WikiLeaks, and who's in prison or in exile or in an embassy? Julian Assange for exposing this type of document while the people committing these war crimes are going scot-free. And they're going scot-free for one major reason, and that's because the country we live in, the United States, gives them its full support. They can commit war crimes, and there's nothing nothing or very little that people can do about it, at least in any of the so-called agencies, whether it's the UN or the UN or the UN courts or international courts. So the tragedy here is one, that obviously Palestinians are being killed en masse. Secondly, that war crimes are being committed openly and notoriously. And third, that the country, the United States, that we live in, is the fundamental supporter of those war crimes. And by that, I want to say, by that, every single member of Congress and the Senate and the House and Obama, who's approved it, who voted to continue to aid Israel in carrying out these war crimes, which is what it, that aid is doing, the military aid, is an aider and abettor of war crimes. Absolutely not any question under international law. So the key here for us in America, certainly, is to get the U.S. To stop its criminal support of Israel.
One of the last times I saw Michael, I was in a singing class with his son Jake and Jake's companion Elena and his daughter Anna and our friend Jennifer Hobbs and my wife Debbie. We took a class on the Upper West Side called Anyone Can Sing. And we were attempting to learn how to sing. And we thought, you know, we'll put Michael on FaceTime and we'll sing his favorite song. Michael's favorite song was the Internationale. And he was home, just out of the hospital, sitting in a padded Barca lounger type chair in his living room, laying back and looking at us on FaceTime. And we were looking at him through the iPhone, and we sang the first verse, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's in birth." And we could see him smiling, laying back in the chair. Then we sang the second verse, "No more tradition's chains shall bind us, arise, ye slaves, no more in thrall. The earth shall rise on new foundations. We have been naught, we shall be all." And Michael was really smiling by then. And then we sang the last verse. And that verse is, "'Tis the final conflict. Let each stand in their place. International humanity shall be the human race." And when we sang the last verse, Michael raised his right fist and he sang along with us in French.
Michael Ratner, I'll really miss you. Bye-bye.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry, come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. people have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled there together when none to laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, and God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. You have the power. Use your voice. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear excerpts from a recent panel of lawyers, activists, and elected officials from the Detroit, Michigan area titled Alternatives to Policing, in which they address the pressing questions confronted by policing in America. What is the abolition movement? What does defunding really mean? How do police reform measures and actions to hold police accountable fit into the abolition defund movement? Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
One of the most pressing issues of the day is policing in America. Notably, how to confront the disproportionate unconstitutional use of force, shootings, arrests, and prosecutions of Black Americans and other people of color with impunity. Can it be reformed, or must it be dismantled? On December 6, our own Julie Hurwitz facilitated a panel discussion at Wayne State Law School called Alternatives to Policing. It was sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild, the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights, the Coalition for Police Transparency and Accountability, and the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and I'm here with Julie to introduce highlights from this important event. Julie, please tell us a bit about each speaker.
Thanks, Heidi. The panelists at this...
Even if we think about the anti-compulsory hijab protests, it would have been very easy for the regime to loosen some of those restrictions or to rein in the quote-unquote morality police, but instead responded with the detention, disappearance, and torture of women activists who were peacefully protesting. And so I think it's led protesters in this moment to see the only feasible outcome as being revolutionary change. And so those chants reflect that. You know, in addition to Jinjian Azadi, protesters are saying, you know, down with the Islamic Republic, death to the dictator.
That's Marie Ranjbar, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Marie Ranjbar on Iran, Zan Zandagi Azadi, Woman, Life, Freedom. Since mid-September, tens of thousands of Iranians have taken to the streets across the country to protest the government's treatment of girls and women, and in particular, mandatory dress codes. These historic demonstrations center on women's socio-political rights and democratic governance in Iran. The government has brutally responded. Hundreds have been killed, including children. Many thousands have been arrested. Despite the regime's violent crackdown, protests have only widened. Demonstrators are shouting, "Death to the dictator." The Islamic Republic, now in its 43rd year, has never faced such sustained and widespread opposition. Can it remain in power? The slogan of the protest movement is "Zan Zandagi Azadi," woman, life, freedom. Our guest today to talk about Iran is Marie Ranjbar. She's assistant professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Her research examines social movements in Iran and integrates feminist political geography with critical human rights and decolonial feminist theory. I talked with her in the studios of KGNU in Boulder. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, David.
Well, since September 16th, with the custodial death of Jina Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman who was arrested for some kind of hijab headscarf infraction, Iran has been convulsed by widespread demonstrations and protests. The protests did not occur in a vacuum. So I'd like you to talk about the context and the role of Iranian women in resistance. Going back to the early part of the 20th century, what's that trajectory look like?
Yeah, thank you for that excellent question. And as you rightly noted, David, Iranian women have always been at the forefront of political activism within Iran. So historically, we can think about women's central roles in the constitutional revolution of the early 1900s. We see women heavily involved in the 1950s nationalist movement, as well as women uniting across ideological lines leading up to the 1979 revolution. And we also see a history of Iranian women's activism, specifically in relation to bodily autonomy, specifically with regards to state-enforced veiling and unveiling, both pre- and post-revolution. So as an example, we can think about the 1936 Unveiling Act. This was an act that was passed by Reza Khan, the first monarch of the Pahlavi monarchy. And he basically passed this act that allowed for the forced unveiling of women in public space. And this was quite extreme at the time. At times, women in public space were forced to unveil at bayonet point. It had the opposite intended effect of having Iranian women in public space. And in fact, many women refused to leave their houses for fears of humiliating encounters with the police. And Reza Khan very much discursively framed this as modernizing women, modernizing Iran. This was part of a larger modernizing project that was predicated on